had a relaxing evening last night.
There were a few stragglers I saw in the bar till 1:30, but they're looking bright and breezy this morning, so welcome back. It's my great pleasure this morning to introduce two people, two colleagues in the field, Rachel Stevenson, who recently has been married, was Rachel Bloom, you might have known her. So Rachel from Reverse Rent, really, really delighted to have her here today to be able to talk to you. So Rachel has been instrumental in setting up Reverse Rent in 2010, and in that time, in those years, has raised in the excess of £3 million for research, which we hopefully will all benefit from. So we're hugely grateful for her, and it's fantastic to see her here then today. Thank you, Rachel. And then joining Rachel is Stuart Cobb, and Stuart. Stuart Cobb is a neurobiology specialist based at the University of Glasgow, where he's worked in the area of Rett syndrome and related genetic disorders of the nervous system for a number of years, and has been at previous Rett weekends, so we're delighted to see him back. Thanks for giving up your time, both of you. Over to you.
Okay, so thank you very much for the introduction. So this is a bit of an experiment, this double act here, so hope it goes well. You'll notice the slides are sort of colour-coded. We have little dots on the corner of each so we don't speak over one another. But as it's a small group, we'd like to keep it quite informal, so if you've any questions as we go along, feel free to indicate, and we're happy to answer questions as we go along. So as we said, I'm Stuart Cobb, I'm a Rett syndrome researcher in Glasgow.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Rachel Stevenson, co-founder and executive director of Reverse Rett. I also serve on the board of trustees for the US-based Rett Syndrome Research Trust. I have a daughter, Amber, who's now 20, who has Rett Syndrome, and also now a stepdaughter who's 15, whose name is Beth, who also has Rett Syndrome. I really would like to thank Rett UK for the opportunity to present to you today, and it's been a really interesting weekend so far, and I hope that you find some of what we have to talk about helpful.
Okay, so so the next slide, so what we hope to do in the next half hour or so is just give an overview of current efforts in terms of finding treatments for Rett syndrome. And this sort of loop here is something that's often seen. So this is a sort of schema for studying disorders and hopefully finding treatments. And you can see that the loop begins and ends with the girls with Rett syndrome. So it begins with understanding the disorder and understanding the basis of the disorder. And this is now understood very well. It's this gene MECP2, and I'm sure you heard about that a lot yesterday with Adrian and the work that's been done there. And once you've identified the underlying biology of the disorder, you can then model that disorder in cells or experimental animal systems so that you can study the disorder, and you can look at what aspects of that are inherently treatable. And this has been done in experimental animals. And once you know about the basic neurobiology and the reversibility of the disorder, you can then identify sites at which you can intervene therapeutically, and you can test experimental treatments in experimental systems and then in clinical trials, and hopefully this results in successful therapy. So this is the loop. Now, the Rett syndrome has been modelled in animals for quite a number of years now, so, you know, fairly soon after the disorder was identified. And the animal models, and there's not just mice, there are other species now, but they mirror the features we see in the girls very closely. So they have the breathing disturbances, they have the hand stereotypies, so they model this very well. And when you reactivate the gene, I'm sure you've heard of this work, these improve. So all features that we've looked at show fundamentally that they can be corrected if we're just smart enough to know how to do that. And that's really where the challenge is, finding ways to do this. It's not been studied. There is a big paper coming out this week in Nature where people have looked at the learning and memory aspect, but it's not been studied directly in these reversal studies yet. So it's... No. So this is the scale of research in Rett syndrome. So what's plotted here, and I'm not showing lots of scientific graphs, but this is a graph of publications in Rett syndrome. So you can see there were virtually no publications. So this is the first report by Andreas Rett, and you can see for the first 20 years or so, there's one or two papers a year. And then there was the first report in English, and this jumps up. So these were originally in German. And then the gene was identified, and suddenly there's this big trajectory. So there's a lot of people now working on Rett syndrome. And you can see the reversal study was here, and suddenly it's zooming up. So there are global efforts directed towards studying Rett syndrome. And the important thing to note is that whilst the original studies were really looking at characterising the disorder clinically and identifying underlying genetic basis of the disorder, many of these latter studies here are actually studies looking at what are the mechanisms by which one could intervene therapeutically. So there's been a big shift in the not only the quantity of the research, but the direction of the research.
So it's important when we're thinking about research to make a distinction between treatments and a cure. When I think of a cure, for me, that's something that will make such a significant difference that it will be life-changing. So it's almost like a condition that had never happened in the first place. When we think about treatment, it's more dealing with a symptom or a subset of symptoms. And as we progress talking about the different approaches to treating Rett syndrome, we just want to manage people's expectations in terms of what different drugs might be able to do, whether there'll be something that can make a dramatic difference to someone's life or are just limited to treating symptoms.
Okay, so this is the... these slides show the sort of classical route for drug discovery and as applied to Rett syndrome. So this is the pathway, if you like, or the critical path for developing new therapies. And there's what's called the discovery phase, which is really understanding the underlying biology of Rett syndrome. So in other words, what is the function of this protein MECP2? And I think Adrian will have talked about that yesterday. And then understanding what happens when MECP doesn't act, it doesn't work. What are the consequences of that? And then knowing what consequences of that are, can you think of ways in which drugs can intervene with these processes to try and correct those things that go wrong? So that's the discovery phase. And then the preclinical phase is testing whether drugs can actually impact on that dysfunction. Can drug molecules fix certain aspects of Rett syndrome? And this can be done at the molecular level or at the level of experimental animals. So in other words, do drugs improve the symptoms of Rett-like symptoms in mice, and is that symptom, is that treatment safe and non-toxic? And if it gets through this phase, then when we go into clinical development, so in other words, this is looking in patients, is the treatment, first of all, is it safe? Is it tolerated? And secondly, does it actually work? Does it actually produce benefit? And if that occurs, then one can go for regulatory approval. So the European Medical Agency in Europe, or the FDA in the United States. And it's only after all these hurdles that one would actually have a therapy that is available for use. Yep. well, we'll talk about this in a minute. So for any completely new medicine, this is a very long process, because this can be 10 to 12 years, typically for a big company. But in rare disorders, there are certain stages that you can jump, you can leapfrog. So it can be quicker, there's quicker regulatory approval. And as we'll come to later, if you can get compounds that are halfway along that path, then it can be, you can speed things up. So we'll come to that in a minute. It's a good point.
So as Stuart was saying, usually the government funds basic science and early discovery, so that in the United States would be the NIH, or here the Medical Research Council. But and then later on in the process, industry takes over, so pharmaceutical companies or biotech companies will pick up the drug and take it into clinical development. And between those two, there's a huge funding gap, which they call the Valley of Death, which often causes huge problems, because it's where there isn't enough money to take great ideas, great breakthroughs that happen early on, into clinical development. And that's really where Reverse Rett and the Rett Syndrome Research Trust operate. So just to explain the partnership between Reverse Rett and the Rett Syndrome Research Trust, the two organisations work closely together. I serve on the board of trustees of RSRT. Monica Coonrads, their executive director, serves on the board of Reverse Rett. A large part of what we do is funding science. So we do a lot of fundraising in order to pay for that science. But we also spend quite a bit of time working out what science to fund, because it's as hard to pick the right research projects to fund as it is to raise the money in the first place. The other thing that we do is we work with the scientific community to identify new areas of interest. So, for example, part of the research Stuart will be talking about in a little while is X activation. And a few years ago, this was an area that no one was really working on. RSRT were the first organisation to take an interest in X activation, funded one lab, then two labs. Now there are six labs, and these labs are now working together as well, to move that further along. As well as that kind of informal collaboration, there's also formal consortiums that have been formed by RSRT. So the MECP2 Gene Therapy Consortium, which Stuart is a part of, and prior to that there was the MECP2 Consortium, which is, you know, three labs, Adrian Bird, Gail Mandel and Mike Greenberg, all working together to try and better understand the underlying causes of Rett syndrome. So these are like scientists who previously were competing with each other, really now all coming together to try and move things closer to our ultimate goal, which is treatment for our children. The other thing that we do is organise science meetings. So sometimes these are broad in focus, so they have people who are working in lots of different areas of research for RSRT coming together for a three-day meeting, sharing information and just making sure everyone understands where everyone else is at. But there's also other meetings that are very focused on one particular area, so X activation or gene therapy. And these are, you know, not things that we advertise. They're invitation-only meetings, but a lot of work is done through those kinds of meetings. And increasingly, we're seeing industry representation at these meetings as they learn more about Rett syndrome and become more interested in being involved. So there's an awful lot going on in Rett syndrome research, and people who, you know, are receiving Google alerts and things will be able to see there's announcements here, there and everywhere happening, and sometimes it's difficult to pick out what's actually happening and where all these different bits of progress fit in the overall big picture. And so Stuart and I today want to try and untangle some of the confusing things about Rett syndrome research for you. And to do that, we want to try and break down the research into the three strategic approaches we're pursuing. Something that I didn't say a minute ago that I think is really important when we were making the distinction between treatments and a cure is that, you know, as parents, I think we'll take anything because we'd just be happy to have some improvement. Some improvement is better than no improvement at all. But trying to just distinguish for you which areas will do what. So starting on this side, the way to address the underlying causes of Rett syndrome, the way to bring a cure about is to target MECP2 as the cause of Rett syndrome. And so Stuart's going to talk about the different elements that are involved in targeting MECP2 in a minute. The other area is suppressor genes. So this is gene modifiers. This is another gene besides MECP2 that a person has a mutation in that protects them from the damaging effects of MECP2. And then there's another area, downstream targets, which is basically things that aren't going to lead to a cure, but that can improve a symptom or a subset of symptoms. So we thought it would be helpful for the purposes of this talk to broadly break down where the different drugs sit in terms of how they work on a very basic level. The first area is about recalibrating brain chemistry. So, for example, ketamine has previously been used as a sedative. It's an anesthetic. But a guy called David Katz found that when he was doing work with rat mice, that they have areas of their brain that are very overactive and areas that are very underactive. And he found that by giving them very tiny doses of ketamine, he could restore the balance back to their brain, and it also improved symptoms like breathing and other neurological symptoms. Then there are two drugs that basically target the same receptor that also have been shown in rat mice to really improve breathing, and those are NLX-101 and ceritizan. Now, Stuart will talk more about this in a minute, but they're drugs that are further back in development. So some drugs like ketamine have already been, you know, they're approved drugs, they're used for something else, you can repurpose them. But these drugs are in development at the moment. So RSRT are funding Neuralixis, the company that owns NLX-101, to move that drug further along so that it'd be ready for clinical trials. And there's another company in Italy that are doing the same work for ceritizan. So we're hoping that, you know, those will be moving into clinical trials in the coming couple of years. The other area is about boosting BDNF. So BDNF is brain-derived neurotrophic factor. That's something that everybody needs in their brain to keep their brain healthy. And we know that people with a lot of different conditions, including Rett syndrome, don't have enough. And so the idea of these kinds of approaches is to boost the levels of BDNF and see if there's any benefit. And we'll talk more about those drugs in a minute, because the top three are all in clinical trials or have been. And then there's another area which is listed at the bottom, which is things that don't fit into either of those two categories. So the NNZ drug, which is a drug that was used to reduce brain degeneration and inflammation after traumatic brain injury, that's been tried in Rett syndrome. The statins, that there's a clinical trial about to start in statins. Those are a modifier, so those come from the middle category suppressor genes. And then there's topoisomerase inhibitors, which are an approach that's come out of the recent paper on long genes. So this is a list of the current clinical trials, those that have just started and those that are ongoing and those that are recently finished. The first one, lovastatin, this is a trial that's taking place in New York. It's a small trial. It's 20 children. They've just finished recruiting, so they'll be starting soon. They're taking children who are 3 years and up who are ambulatory. So we'll see how that goes. The IGF-1 trial, I'm sure everybody's heard about. The recently published results show that the drug was safe and tolerated. The improvements have been modest and quite inconsistent, and they've been asked to increase their numbers, so that will need to move to a bigger trial. Fingolimod is a drug that was previously used for multiple sclerosis. It's quite similar to Copaxone, but Copaxone is injectable, whereas fingolimod is oral. It's taking place in Switzerland, and I have nothing else to say about that one. So the Copaxone trial, there's been two trials, one in Israel and one in New York. The New York trial has recently finished. Again, it was a small trial. Basically, it was taking a stab at seeing whether or not there was any improvement. This, again, it's an MS drug. I think there were 10 children enrolled in that trial, and the results have been interesting. They're about to send a paper for publication. The NNZ drug is also known as trofinetide. There's no published results from this, but an announcement from the pharmaceutical company, you know, states that it's been safe and tolerated, and that they need to do some further work to see if there's any real symptom improvement. And soon the ketamine trial will be starting. So this is going to be a trial where there's going to be 4 doses of ketamine, 1 placebo, and 3 different levels of ketamine. And basically just it'll be blinded, so people won't know if they're receiving the drug or the placebo which time. And then they'll just observe the patients to see how they're doing. And hopefully there'll be some improvement there. I think that they're expecting the outcome to be improvements in breathing, amongst other.
There's a number of other ketamine-like drugs that are also being used, experimental compounds, but I don't know, it depends on the outcome measures are different between studies, but...
I think, and also they've changed the endpoints for the ketamine clinical trial so that the outcome measure is basically safety, just because of the fact that it's so hard to measure some of these other issues, but I think what they saw in the rat mice was that it improved breathing, and I think a few other smaller things. Yes, can you rewind and I'll say. So, just basically wanted to give you the big picture of just the things that are happening at the moment that are relevant to people who have children with Rett syndrome. The lovastatin clinical trial is being funded by the Rett Syndrome Research Trust and Reverse Rett. And the IGF-1 trial was funded by IRSF, RettSyndrome.org. Fingolimod, I don't know who's funding that one. And dextromethorphan, that's happening in Maryland, and it's similar to ketamine, but it's a bit of a weaker drug. The Copaxone trials have been funded by Rett Syndrome Research Trust and Reverse Rett. NNZ2566 is RettSyndrome.org, I think, and the ketamine trial is Reverse Rett and Rett Syndrome Research Trust. So there's quite a good mix of different organisations supporting clinical trials. Well, I think, you know, when we were talking a few minutes ago about breaking the treatment strategies down, the things that are going to cover probably a lot of issues and give us a big change are going to be things that target the underlying problem, which is this missing protein that we know if you put it back, it helps the symptoms in a more dramatic way. These are all these things that have been tried at the clinical trial level at the moment. They're not things that we hope are going to deliver a cure. They're not going to give us this dramatic improvement we're looking for, but they might give a significant improvement in a number of areas. I think it's good to see a strong focus on the breathing problems, because this is an area that affects so many people with Rett syndrome. But we know that that's tied into so many other problems and autonomic dysfunction. So I think that the likelihood is that there will be other things that improve as a result of addressing that, rebalancing that brain chemistry.
And I guess we should say that the first studies tend to be safety, and is it safe and do they tolerate this? And there are some outcome measures, but they're not what was the primary goal of the study in the first instance. So this relates to the question you asked earlier about existing drugs versus novel drugs. So you'll see that quite a number of the the drugs are, that are being looked at are this is what's called repositioning existing drugs. And this is a big advantage because these are all drugs that are already licensed for other disorders. So they have a safety profile. They're known to be safe. They're available. They're not. They've not always been tested in children, and this is an issue. So there are a lot of advantages. You can see this would really speed up the process to achieving a therapy. But the disadvantage of these is that they're not disease modifying. They're unlikely to affect the underlying cause of Rett syndrome. So they're likely to only ever be effective in particular sets of symptoms. They're not going to be this sort of global. And the other, so the other class is new drugs. So these are new molecules that have not been, they've not reached the, they've not been licensed yet. So this is coming earlier in this pipeline. So the advantages of these, some of these drugs, is that they may be more targeted towards the underlying cause of the disorder, but the disadvantage is that they take longer. Some of them are completely experimental, so there are completely experimental drugs which you have to do the safety testing before you can go on. Some others, this one sort of sits in between, so it's although it's not licensed, it's gone through very late phase 3 clinical trials, so it's known to be safe, but it's not actually licensed yet, but it just wasn't efficacious or effective in another disorder. But, you know, if it was shown to have some benefit in Rett syndrome, it could proceed quite rapidly. So these are the sort of two groups of drugs.
So if you cast your mind back to a few minutes ago, we showed you the treatment strategy slide, and first we talked about the downstream targets, and then we have the area that Stuart will talk about in a minute, which is targeting the underlying problem, the missing MECP2. In the middle, we have another area called about modifier genes, and to explain modifier genes, you know, we all know somebody, say, who's smoked for a long time who ended up with lung cancer. And similarly, we also know people who've smoked for a long time who haven't developed lung cancer. And the chances are that these are people that have some other kind of something else in their genetic makeup that's protecting them from the disease. And so for Rett syndrome, we're looking for gene modifiers as well. We're funding two projects looking for gene modifiers. The first is at Monica Justice's lab. She's in Toronto. She used to be at Baylor. It's a really large project with many thousands of mice. And what she does is she gives the mice, male mice, mutations using a drug, and then mates them to female Rett mice, and then observes the offspring basically to see if there are any who are doing exceptionally well. And then when she finds ones that are doing very well, sequences their genome to try and identify mutations in other genes that might be protecting them from the damaging effects of MECP2. So she's about halfway through the screen. She's found about 20 to 30 modifiers. And one of those has been found in the cholesterol pathway. It's called SQLE. And that is how we got to the statins trial. So we'll talk more about that. The other project that we're funding is Jeff Newell. He is looking at girls with Rett syndrome. So we all know women and girls with Rett syndrome who are exceptionally well. These will be people who might still speak, walk, sing, run, use a pen. We even know of a family who have a daughter who is in mainstream school, 9 years old, getting a B in maths. So he's working on sequencing the exome of girls who are doing exceptionally well and girls who are very poorly, and trying to see if there's any mutations that he can pick out to find modifiers.
Yeah, so I guess end off talking about therapies that attempting to target the underlying cause of Rett syndrome. And there's reason to believe from the animal experiments of Adrian Bird that these would actually cause quite a result in quite a profound reversal of the disorder if this was achievable. So as you're aware, the gene through this intermediary step you're making RNA makes a protein, and in Rett syndrome there's a mutation in the gene which results in a protein that doesn't work correctly. So these therapies are basically trying to either correct or replace the faulty gene or replace or correct the faulty protein. So a very obvious strategy is actually, if you've got a disorder where you know there's a gene that doesn't work, it's faulty, can you just go in and replace that gene? And this is the concept of gene therapy. And gene therapy has had this sort of rocky history, so there's been highs and lows. But recently there has been a massive resurgence of interest. So the pharmaceutical companies are all very interested in this. There are many, many clinical trials for other disorders looking at gene therapy. And the Rett Syndrome Research Trust and Reverse Rett have set up a consortium of labs who are working on this. So the concept's quite straightforward. You take your gene, MECP2, a working copy, and you deliver that gene to cells so that you restore functional MECP2. And the way this is done is it's packaged in a virus. So the gene is put in a virus, which is what's called a non-pathogenic virus. The virus doesn't cause disease in its own right. It's simply a vehicle. If you like, it's like a capsule for delivering a drug. It's the same thing as a capsule that's delivering genetic material, DNA, to replace the gene. The big challenge is actually delivering it to the nervous system, because we believe the nervous system is where you need to get it, and it's very difficult to target drugs to the nervous system, and also delivering it at the correct amount, because we know with MECP2 the level of MECP2 is really critical. If you have too little, you have Rett syndrome. If you have too much, this can cause neurological effects as well. So really all the work is going in to try and optimise the system to see whether we can deliver it at the correct levels. There's some encouraging data. So this is work of Gail Mandel, and this is if you like a neurological score in mice, and you can see that untreated mice the neurological score is going up, but those that are given a virus which is a clinical grade virus that could be used as a therapy, you can see it's reducing the neurological score. So this is all work ongoing. So that's gene therapy, and then a variant of this is what Rachel's talked about, is targeting the silent copy of MECP2. So as you know, MECP2 is on the X chromosome, and all the girls with Rett syndrome have in every cell there are two copies of the X chromosome. There are two copies of MECP2, and it's only one of them that's faulty. And the way it works is that in cells, one of the copies is switched off randomly. So roughly in half the cells in the body, half the cells in the brain, it's the faulty copy that's present and causing the disorder. And the other half of the cells, it's the normal working copy. But in all those cells that have the faulty copy working, there is actually a switched off working copy. So the strategy for this X inactivation is if we can go into nerve cells, go into the nucleus, if we can sort of remove this padlock here and switch back on this copy of MECP2. And this has a lot of advantages because it addresses the underlying cause of Rett syndrome. You don't need to deliver a gene, so you don't have these issues of that. And also this question of dosage is not a problem, because there is one copy of MECP2, it's regulated normally as it should. So conceptually, this is a really an ideal therapy. The question is, how do you actually achieve this? And you can see, so this is from a recent meeting at the University of North Carolina, There are teams in place, several labs now working together to try and achieve this strategy.
So while there are a lot of clinical trials taking place and drugs in development, we know that it's kind of common knowledge across the globe that we need to do more to improve the design of clinical trials for Rett syndrome. And one of the major problems we have is about outcome measures. So how do you assess whether or not something is working? How, you know, we all know that girls with Rett syndrome are very variable, and also their symptoms are variable over periods of time. So to try and take data from them, you know, to measure outcome on one day might be different from in 3 days' time, etc. So there's work ongoing both in America and in the UK to try and refine outcome measures and improve them for girls and women with Rett syndrome. There's also work into finding biomarkers for Rett syndrome. So ideally this would be something in the blood, urine or spinal fluid, which correlates to disease severity. So it would be something that, you know, you could give a treatment, then you could measure this level to see whether it went up or down, to let you know whether or not you're improving things, rather than relying on the kind of outcome measures that we've had in previous years, which are basically questionnaire-based, quite anecdotal. So that's just a picture of myself and our chair, John Sharp, with Dr. Santos, who's at King's College London, who's working on outcome measures for reverse Rett.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about work that's been funded by organisations, but this slide is just sort of illustrating the point that the pharmaceutical and biopharmaceutical and biotechnology industry has sort of woken up to rare disorders. And whilst in the past rare disorders were thought to be something, you know, rare disorders, there's not a market there. It's a very difficult area to operate in financially. Actually, there's been a sea change in this attitude, and virtually every big pharmaceutical company now have big programs on rare disorders. And the reasons for this are numerous. One is often the biology is much better understood. So if a company is trying to develop a therapy for something like schizophrenia, which is very complex, and we don't know what the genes are that are involved, we don't know what the mechanisms are, it's very difficult to think, although it's, you know, it's very common, it's very difficult to think of a starting point. But with rare disorders, it's often very clear. You start with MECP2 in the case of Rett syndrome. The other things that have attracted them are there are acts, so that you can see the Orphan Drug Act in the United States, and also the Orphan Drug designation. So there are financial incentives. So companies actually get enhanced patent protection. So they get prolonged patent life for rare disorders. And if they're running clinical trials, if companies are running clinical trials, they get pretty hefty tax reductions as well to try and encourage work on rare disorders. And there are a number of, so the clinical trials are substantially cheaper. And they also make more money from these drugs as well. So there's a lot of things driving that. And there are several companies now that are very interested in Rett syndrome. There are no companies with major programs in Rett syndrome, but there are Rett syndromes right up there in terms of rare disorders. It's sort of one of the ones that, you know, they keep most eyes on and are interested in moving into. So I think that's it. We've left time for questions. We put this link here at the bottom. If you want to keep updated on clinical trials, this web address here will keep you updated on all clinical trials. So it links directly into the clinical trials for Rett syndrome, and you can keep updated on progress as they're posted. But I think we'll stop now, and we're happy to take any questions you have. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, we at Reverse Rec, we've been trying to do some of that. We have some news articles which we're calling Research Made Easy. And the idea of that is to try and simplify recent developments. We could use to do it all from the beginning, but at the moment it's just like the most, you know, recent things that come out. But we understand, you know, Rett syndrome is complex and the science is complicated, but the most important thing to us is that we make it accessible to people, because, you know, why would people be interested in research if they really don't know what's happening? And I think I'm glad we've had the chance to do this talk today and be able to break it down so that people have an overview. And now if you then read the Research Made Easy articles that come out after, that would be helpful. And the next thing I'm going to do, on might as well say it on the record, is ask Stuart to do one about gene therapy, because the ones that we've been doing recently are just, you know, things that have come out in the last sort of year.
Yeah, so it's such a new area that it's difficult to say, but there's very encouraging data coming out. So the reason that one of the X chromosomes is switched off is that it's for gene dosage. So if you have too many copies of a gene, this is damaging. But it turns out, in fact, that for the it may be that, you know, it's damaging during early development, but if it's switched back on and you have slightly too much, or if it compensates, if there's compensatory mechanisms, which there appear to be. So in other words, you can switch on an extra copy and somehow the cell adapts, so it sort of titrates the levels again. So you've got a working copy and all the other genes sort of normalize. This happens in biology. There's sort of homeostatic mechanisms, they're called, which tend to revert everything back to sort of steady levels. So that might occur. So the critical thing is whether you can actually do it, because the gene's not just switched off, it's really switched off. So can one develop molecules and things that can do that? And people have been finding molecules that do that. The question is, you know, how specific they are for MECP2, and do they switch on other things? So in Angelman syndrome, which is another single gene disorder, they've screened drugs and find a particular drug which is a licensed drug which does that for their gene. It switches back on this silent, so it's not an X chromosome, it's another gene, but it switches back on this gene. So I think there is hope, and there's from initially funding one lab, there's enough hope to really intensify efforts in that area.
Some of the labs are looking at reactivating the entire chromosome, and others are looking at specifically just MECP2. That's why they do it in mice, and, you know, find out what the damaging effects are before trying anything.
I think the expectation was it would be devastating, but the studies that have come out suggest that that's not the case. So it seems to be that there is this rebalance. So with, you know, extra copies of genes, you know, of course the chromosomes are numbered, starting with the biggest and getting smaller. So certainly, you know, the extra copies of the large genes, it's lethal down to a certain chromosome. So there is this, but whether this is during development.
It's a bit, it's
Well, I although people are adopting both strategies, the feeling is obviously if you can selectively reactivate just this small chunk of the X chromosome, then that would have far few off-target effects, if you like. It would be much more pinpoint. It's how achievable that will be. That's very active work at the moment.
Apparently, you don't need to. Apparently, it just evens out from what the data that's come out already.
Well, they've looked at reactivating in the mouse, but in cells, the finding is if you reactivate that chromosome, you don't get twice the levels of transcript. It normalizes the levels, so there seems to be some regulation that we're unaware of. The thing is, if it was complete regulation, then you would envisage, well, what about the duplication system? If there's this feedback, that wouldn't be a problem. So I think people are looking at that. But it does seem to be, and we now know that there's always been this question also, if you have a faulty copy of MECP2, would it interrupt the activity of a working copy? Because you could imagine you've got a faulty protein that's sort of in the part of the cell where it should be but not working properly. Would it interfere if you come in and deliver a working copy? But that appears not to be the case. We have experimental evidence that it doesn't interfere when you deliver a working copy of the MECP molecule.
I think the position would be that we would work as much as we could with NICE and with the NHS to try and make sure that drugs are approved. There are a lot of problems that people in UK disease groups are having, trying to push drugs through, which you've probably heard about with Duchenne muscular dystrophy and Morquio syndrome, and we're trying to sort of keep our ear to the ground and learn as much as we can about the process of, drug approval. And it's a bit of a minefield. But to be honest, when my daughter was diagnosed in the year 2000, there was no kind of even discussion about treatments and cures and the potential for having to have these arguments. And I think as rep parents, we're all familiar with fighting at every stage for everything that you ever need. And I think that will be another thing that we have to take on. And I feel very fortunate that Becky and I are working together, and that between, RET UK and Reverse RET, we'll be able to deal with some of these difficult battles that are no doubt ahead.
Yeah, we're not sort of expert in health economics here, but, the financial cost of, a childhood intellectual disability disorder is massive compared to other, rare cancers and so on. I mean, if one had a profound therapy that really, impacted in Rett syndrome, then there'd be a very, very strong case, I would believe.
Just add as well, if anyone has any further questions, you can email either of us if anything comes to mind after. But thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
Right, this is a quick commercial break. Many of you will have seen from Ret News that we had a challenge event last year. It was really popular and went very well, and it was a very sociable day that we had when we did the Three Nines Challenge with an abseil. Well, it was suggested that we do whitewater rafting next year. So I've been investigating that, and if you would like to take part in the whitewater rafting, we'll do it either in May or June. And if you would like information about it, if you come sign up with me, I'll keep you informed about it. And is Jerry Henderson here? Jerry Henderson has done the whitewater rafting, and we would be doing it in the on the Olympic site at Lee Valley Park. So if you ask Jerry, stand up, please. He's there. If you ask Jerry, he'll tell you all about it because he's already done it. Thank you. And now I'm going to hand over to Becky for the closing speech.
Okay, this is fairly brief because the aquariums are closing. But really want to say, I certainly hope you've enjoyed the weekend as much as I have. Although I know from personal experience as a parent, it can also be very draining and emotionally tiring. I hope, though, that you will leave armed with new information, having reacquainted yourself with old friends and made some new ones. People who are with you on this roller coaster and who you know really understand what it's all about. This is a slightly odd experience for me, having helped organise this event when 18 years ago, almost to the day, I was here with Rosie, then 18 months old, to meet Dr. Kerr. We'd already met a family, who in fact are here today, and we already suspected that Rosie had Rett syndrome from a newspaper article that they'd written, and we contacted them. After meeting the family, we went to meet our local paediatrician at the Child Development Centre. We asked her straight away, does Rosie have Rett syndrome? She looked really taken aback and said, how do you even know about it, as though it should be some sort of secret. She then went on to say that we couldn't possibly discuss that until she was at least 4 or 5 years old, as it was a developmental disorder. She was 17 months old at the time. Not being prepared to lose those first few years and sitting back watching her regress, I got back to the family who put us in touch with Rett UK. Hence, we arrived at this hotel to meet Dr. Kerr and to get confirmation of her diagnosis. Needless to say, Dr. Kerr took one look at her and said as gently as she could, yes, of course she is. She wrote to our paediatrician, and from that point on, we got access to the help and support we all needed at local level because they now knew what they were dealing with, and from Rett UK. So for us, our journey with Rett UK goes back a long way. And that early diagnosis for Rosie and access to a wealth of information through Rett UK has helped her to be as well as she is today. Many of you will also know that 3 years ago, when Rosie was really ill with complications related to her breathing, it was Rett UK that ultimately provided the answers that I believe saved her life. The reason I share this with you is to show the difference that access to support, information and advice can make. We hope with all our hearts that there is a cure for Rett syndrome around the corner, that there are going to be drugs that will help deal with certain aspects of the disorder. We wholeheartedly support our colleagues who are driving for the research to achieve our dreams. We have a blue sky picture that Rett UK will no longer be needed, that no more families will have to hear those words uttered, I'm sorry, your child has Rett syndrome. Until that day comes, we intend to be here to help you deal with the everyday challenges that living with Rett syndrome presents. We are on this roller coaster with you. We're sharing the highs and the lows, but always looking forward to a blue sky day. So only remains a couple of things, really big things though. Thank you to all the people, the families who have come and attended, the professionals, our colleagues who have given up their time, sharing their knowledge and experience with us. To the office team, who the gals have worked incredibly hard, really long days, to make this happen. And to all our trustees who supported us with that. And finally, to Kim and the hotel team, who really oiled the cogs and kept the wheels turning for us. And done it really in such a warm and friendly way. We're really grateful to them. So, just very last thing I would ask you to do, which is really important, and sorry, it is a form. And I know you all hate filling out forms, but the reason we can do weekends like this is because we get support from our funders
and they want to know the difference it makes to you, the families. Without that, we will really struggle to put events on this. I know it's hideous. I know you will hate forms, but please, please, please fill out your evaluation. Be honest. We want to know the good, the bad, the ugly. That's absolutely fine. If we don't know, we can't move forward and we can't improve. So finally, just last couple of bits then. The care rooms are closing now, so please collect your children. We're going to have a quick rejigging here of the chairs because we're then going to have a fun interactive music session which is led by Cockabit. We're just changing the chairs into a circular format. Then we will do the fun session and then we'll be closing and have lunch. So thank you everyone for coming. Have a safe journey home and we hope to see you again soon. Sorry, one very last quick thing which I wanted to add is we will be putting the presentations with audio recordings onto the website, but please don't look for them on Monday because they won't be there at some point.